From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This morning, the committee begins public hearings on the National Security Agency, or as it is more commonly known, the NSA.
30 years ago, the Church Committee investigated the Nixon administration's widespread surveillance of U.S. citizens, leading Congress to pass the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. As the NSA once again comes under scrutiny for domestic wiretapping, we'll speak with the chief counsel to the Church Committee, Frederick Schwartz. The secret domestic surveillance program is now being criticized by an unlikely source, a former NSA director, Bobby Ray Inman.
My own view, this activity was not authorized by a resolution. Use whatever force you need to do. There clearly was a line in the FISA statutes which says you couldn't do this.
Then the Army Surgeon General issues an unusual warning about the upcoming HBO documentary Baghdad ER, that military personnel watching it could experience symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Here in the Medical Task Force 86, we have over 700 soldiers. You know, learn about war by walking through this facility. Just the horrors of what man can do to man are visualized right here. But we do our best, our level best, to make sure our people survive and make it back to their homes.
We'll speak with the filmmakers of Baghdad ER, as well as a military doctor who spent a year as an emergency medical physician in Baghdad and the mother of a soldier killed in Iraq. But first, the Justice Department launches a criminal investigation of the New York Police Department over its treatment of protesters during the Republican National Convention. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Has learned the Justice Department has launched a criminal civil rights investigation into the New York Police Department over the NYPD's treatment of protesters during the RNC. During the week of the 2004 convention, police arrested some 1,800 protesters, more than at any previous political convention in the country's history. We'll have more on this story after headlines. After months of resistance, the Bush administration has agreed to brief all members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees on its domestic wiretapping program. Analysts said the decision was made to shore up support for CIA nominee General Michael Hayden, who oversaw the National Security Agency when the program was introduced. Hayden's confirmation hearings begin Thursday. Republican strategists cited another benefit. Because of congressional rules over classified information, lawmakers would be forced to temper public discussion of the program once they were briefed on it. One senior Republican aide told the Los Angeles Times, quote, "When they know about it, they're obligated to be quiet." In other news, Iran has rejected a European proposal that would grant it several incentives for halting nuclear enrichment activities. The incentives would include a light water nuclear reactor. Announcing his rejection, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said, quote, "Do you think you're dealing with a four-year-old child to whom you can give walnuts and chocolates and get gold from him?" The proposal was also rejected by the U.S. A new arms embargo on Venezuela is heightening tensions between the Bush and Chavez governments. On Monday, the U.S. announced it's banning arms sales to Venezuela because it has not cooperated with the Bush administration's so-called anti-terror efforts. Venezuelan officials said the ban is laying the political groundwork for a possible attack. On Tuesday, State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick responded to the allegation.
Look, you know, it's just an attempt to sort of obscure the issue. And what they should instead be focusing on is cooperating in the war against terrorism. There are UN resolutions that that guide should be a guide for every country's efforts in that regard. So I think that they should, instead of throwing up sort of diversionary rhetoric and overheated rhetoric, they might focus instead on actually taking steps to fight terror.
in response to the arms embargo. President Chavez says he's considering sending U.S. F-16s to Iran. In Colombia, thousands of indigenous Colombians blocked a major southern highway Tuesday to protest a pending trade agreement with the United States. Organizers said the blockade drew more than 30,000 people. At least 30 people were reported injured when police used tear gas on the crowds. Government officials accused the demonstrators of being a front for the rebel group Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. Indigenous leader José Antonio Catome had this response.
Here they are attacking us with helicopters. They are attacking also with bullets. That is, they are attacking in different ways as if we were an illegal group. And it is totally false that this was encouraged by the FARC. We take responsibility for this.
In Bolivia Tuesday, the government released details of plans to distribute unused land to the country's poor peasants. Officials said over 12 million acres of land would initially be given out. Bolivian Vice President Alvaro Garcia Linera said privately owned productive farmland would not be affected and called for a public dialogue.
Con los campesinos,
with the farmers, with the indigenous, with all the social sectors involved in the issue of land, it is necessary to bring together points of conflict, to talk about them at the table, look at them from one side, look at them from the other, and at the end of a month, 2 months, or 3 months, we will begin to make decisions again.
In Brazil, the death toll for more than 5 days of gang and police violence in Sao Paulo has reached at least 115 people. Clashes broke out last week when one of Brazil's leading gangs launched a series of attacks. Following the announcement, several of the gang's imprisoned leaders would be transferred to different facilities. The gangs targeted police stations, military installations, and prison outposts. Police said they have made at least 90 arrests. In Iraq, the London Independent's reporting violence in the town of Basra has worsened to the point where one person is being assassinated every hour. Meanwhile, a survey carried out by the Iraqi government and UNICEF has concluded a quarter of all Iraqi children suffer from malnutrition. Back in the United States, the Justice Department has released new video footage of the 9/11 attack on the Pentagon. The video shows American Airlines Flight 77 approaching the Pentagon at nearly ground level. Moments later, the Pentagon is seen in flames. Judicial Watch, the public interest group that obtained the video's release, said it hoped the footage helps put to rest theories the Pentagon was hit by something other than a hijacked plane. Mexico has announced it may take legal action in response to President Bush's plan to deploy thousands of troops to the border. On Tuesday, Mexican officials said they would file lawsuits in U.S. courts if the National Guard took part in detaining and/or mistreating detainees. In Washington, President Bush defended his plan.
I made it clear to the country last night that we're not going to militarize our border. Mexico is a friend. But what we are going to do is use assets necessary to make sure that we can assure the American people that the border is secure.
In Nebraska, the NAACP has filed a lawsuit over a new law that divides Omaha public schools into three racially identifiable districts. Under the law, the Omaha district will be split into three, one mostly black, one largely Latino, and one predominantly white. The NAACP called the plan a reversion to segregation. In Georgia, a judge has struck down a ban on same-sex marriage. The court ruled the measure had violated constitutional rules on single-issue voting when it appeared on the ballot 2 years ago. The ban was originally passed as part of a ballot question that included several other questions, a practice barred under state law. In Los Angeles, city and state officials have filed suit against Coca-Cola, accusing it of distributing contaminated soft drinks. The suit says millions of Coke bottles sold over the last 4 years have been tainted with lead. Coca-Cola called the allegations outlandish. And a new poll shows public confidence in Republican governance has hit its lowest point since President Bush took office. According to the Washington Post, a wide majority of Americans say they have more trust in Democrats to deal with Iraq, the economy, immigration, and several other major issues. The results suggest the Democrats' favorable rating has less to do with public support for its policies than with dissatisfaction with the Republicans. More than half of those surveyed said the Democrats have not offered a sharp contrast to President Bush and the Republican Party. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Has learned the Justice Department has launched a criminal investigation into the New York Police Department over the NYPD's treatment of protesters during the Republican National Convention. Last week, the FBI sent the New York Civil Liberties Union a letter asking the group for assistance in what it described as a, quote, pending criminal civil rights investigation into the New York City Police Department's arrest of certain individuals in connection with their protest activity at the Republican National Convention in August of 2004. The letter went on to state, quote, we are attempting to determine if any police officers violated federal civil rights statutes. During the week of the 2004 convention, police arrested some 1,800 protesters, more than at any previous political convention in the country's history. It's unclear as to the extent of the Justice Department's criminal investigation of the NYPD, but the FBI appears to be focusing on the arrest of Dennis Kine, a Gulf War veteran turned anti-war activist. Kine was arrested on the steps of the New York Public Library on multiple charges, including inciting a riot. His case went to trial, but it was dismissed after his legal team presented videotaped evidence that proved the police lied to the court. As part of the criminal investigation, the FBI is seeking to interview other protesters whose constitutional rights have been violated by the police. The police department has acknowledged it's opened its own investigation into the arrest of Kine and is cooperating with the FBI. The announcement of the FBI investigation of NYPD comes just a week after the city's own Civilian Complaint Review Board issued a report criticizing the actions of two deputy police chiefs during the convention. We're joined right now in our Firehouse studio by attorney Gideon Oliver. He's representing Dennis Kine and other protesters arrested during the convention. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
It's very good to have you with us. So the Bush administration Justice Department is launching an investigation into the New York Police Department's activities during the Republican convention. Can you explain how you found this out and what you think?
Certainly. The first I heard of this, an FBI investigation was yesterday, late yesterday afternoon, actually, although I understood that as a result of a letter that John Conyers and several other House Judiciary members sent to Attorney General Gonzalez last year, that the Department of Justice would be launching some kind of investigation. So this is the first I've heard that something is actually going on. So it was really only yesterday.
Explain what happened to your client, to Dennis Kine.
Dennis, on August 31st, 2004, went to the steps of the New York Public Library at around 6 p.m., was there for a few minutes before police began, before a large number of NYPD officers began searching people's backpacks and arresting people, which caused many of the folks who were at the library to get upset and to chant and do other entirely peaceful things, as a result of which the police officers gave dispersal orders. And Dennis was arrested as he was walking away and leaving and yelling at the police. And when he was being placed under arrest, when he was on his knees with his hands behind his back, the then Deputy Commissioner of Legal Matters, the top lawyer for the police department, came over to him and pointed to him and said, this one is discon and resisting. Disorderly conduct and resisting arrest.
And who was the officer?
The deputy, then it was Stephen Hammerman, he's no longer the Deputy Commissioner of Legal Matters. Deputy Commissioner of Legal Matters Hammerman then walked over to a Legal Bureau lieutenant who was nearby and said, we got one of the troublemakers from Pataki's the other night, referring to Dennis. So it's very eerie because at least he knew who Dennis was from a protest several days before, and referred to him as a troublemaker, was pleased he had been arrested, and ordered that he be charged with something he was absolutely not doing, which was resisting arrest.
You had this on film?
Yes.
This is what broke this case?
Well, what happened is that the district attorney, based on Officer Matthew Wohl's sworn accusatory instrument in Dennis's case, prosecuted him. It was the first jury trial to result from the RNC. And Officer Wohl testified and that he observed Dennis resisting arrest by kicking and screaming like a little child. When asked how he was moving around, he said, well, his heart was moving, chest was moving.
His heart was moving?
Yes. and after Officer Wohl testified, we turned over some videotape to the district attorney one evening, and then the next morning they sort of pulled us into the hallway and said, why didn't you show this to us earlier? They obviously understood very quickly that the officer hadn't told the truth. And, you know, we said, well, why didn't, you know, he tell the truth? Why didn't you dismiss the case?
So this Officer Wohl is being investigated by the FBI?
Well, it appears so. I know, as a matter of fact,
they name him in the letter that we saw.
They spell his name wrong, but yes.
How do you spell his name?
Name him. It's W O H L, and they spell it W H O L. Perhaps a minor detail, but it's a very, very long time. I mean, Dennis's trial was in December of 2004, so this is a real long time to have waited to investigate what is really a flagrant, I think, example of what was a much larger problem during the RNC, which is to say the police department had a policy of clearing the streets and then kind of sorting everything out in criminal court in terms of making it sound as though the arrests were legitimate later, which is, you know, an enormous problem that's, frankly, ongoing in terms of the police department's policing of protest activity, certainly.
We're talking to Gideon Oliver, attorney representing Dennis Kine, arrested at the Republican National Convention, and others. These cases leading to the Justice Department, the FBI, sending a letter to the New York Civil Liberties Union saying they're investigating the police department over criminal civil rights violations, criminal violations. Can you describe other cases that you know about? We have some video, and you know some of that video.
Certainly. Well, during the RNC, five was the golden number. That is to say, arresting officers were to arrest, the police department says, up to five individuals in a mass arrest situation. And in fact, Officer Wohl swore that he arrested five individuals that day at the library. And as it turns out, we have video of the arrests of all five of those individuals, and Officer Wohl doesn't appear anywhere near them at any time. It appears that he was at the back of a prisoner transport vehicle. And so the first arrests that occurred at the library that day were of two French-Canadian men and a woman from Portland who were arrested for attempting to hang a banner. They didn't even hang it. They just held it up. A police captain came up to them and said, you can't hang a sign on Parks Department property. You can hold it, but you can't hang it. And then within 4 or 5 seconds, a number of other captains and officers swept in and simply arrested them, which seemed to, you know, just flabbergast the crowd, the people who were there.
We're going to show for our radio listeners some of the videotape on our website at democracynow.org. Now, the John Conyers letter to the Justice Department pointed out that 91% of the protesters arrested had their charges dropped. 91% had their charges dropped or were found to be not guilty after trial, and that about 400 protesters were let off the hook after video evidence emerged proving the protesters had been wrongly accused as a result of police perjury, the tampering of evidence, or other deceptions. That's quite astounding.
Yes.
91%.
Absolutely. And it's also, I think, important to note that what we're talking about in terms of the violations of law, or alleged violations of law we're talking about things like disorderly conduct or parading without a permit. And when a police officer swears out an accusatory instrument that initiates a criminal proceeding, it's a misdemeanor to tell a lie. in a document like that. And many, many of the police officers who swore out these instruments during the convention simply did not tell the truth. It's a huge, huge problem. So I'm very interested to see what comes of this FBI investigation. If it's, you know, just did, you know, Officer Matthew Wall, you know, tell a lie when he was on the stand in Dennis's case, that's open and shut. But if it's, you know, if it's, how could this have been such a widespread practice? That would be a very interesting, you know, question to have a more definitive answer.
And on Democracy Now!, we showed the videotape that was doctored by the police department, that was proved in court when the longer video was brought out that showed precisely the opposite of what they supposedly said happened.
I believe that was in connection with Alexander Dunlop's case. He was arrested on August 27th in connection, allegedly in connection with the critical mass bike ride. It turned out he had lived in the neighborhood and was going to get some sushi, and he was a guy with a bike, and they were arresting people with bikes. And in connection with his case, the district attorney's office turned over one videotape that did not show him acting, you know, completely reasonably and trying to figure out how to get out of the police trap. And Eileen Clancy from Eyewitness Video discovered that the video was incomplete, comparing it to another copy that had been turned over in another case. It's extremely troubling. These are extremely troubling practices.
Does this go to an issue of conspiracy?
Well, I think it depends what you mean by conspiracy. I think certainly at this point, the fact that Commissioner Kelly and Paul Brown are so adamant about defending all of the practices of the police department in connection with the convention, despite really overwhelming evidence that there were serious problems, certainly points toward premeditation. And post hoc rationalization. So I would certainly call it a conspiracy, at least in the technical legal sense.
So 1,800 people arrested, largest in any convention in the history of conventions. Over 1,600 of them, these cases were dropped or shown in trial, acquitted, etc. We want to thank you very much for being with us. Gideon Oliver, attorney representing protesters arrested at the Republican National Convention. We'll certainly continue to follow the story, and we'll also link to the stories we covered at the Republican Convention, including Alex Dunlop and the video we showed there of the man who went out to buy sushi and was arrested for protesting. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Watching the detectives, Elvis Costello here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 420 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR, college and community and low-power FM stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. On Thursday, the Senate Intelligence Committee will open its confirmation hearing for General Michael Hayden to become the next director of the CIA. Hayden's the former head of the National Security Agency, who authorized the agency in 2001 to begin monitoring the phone calls of U.S. citizens without legally required court warrants. While Hayden and the Bush administration have defended the secret domestic surveillance program, it's now being criticized by an unlikely source, a former director of the NSA. Last week, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, who headed the NSA from 1977 to 1981, spoke in New York at a forum sponsored by the New York Public Library and the Century Foundation. It was part of the library's Live at the NYPL series. Besides an article at the website Wired News, Inman's statements have received almost no media attention, even though he's believed to be the highest-ranking former NSA official to speak out about the program. At the forum, he disputed the Bush administration's claim that Congress authorized the secret spy program when it authorized the president to use force following the September 11th attacks. Inman also said the program clearly contradicts the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which Congress passed in 1978 at the time he was head of the National Security Agency.
My own view, this activity was not authorized by a resolution, use whatever force you need to do. There clearly was a line in the FISA statutes which says you couldn't do this.
Former NSA Director Bobby Ray Inman also said Congress should consider rewriting the FISA Act to account for changes in technology, but to prevent the administration from continuing to do what it's doing.
In carefully crafting legislation, you should leave the prospect of an emergency situation and a limited response to that emergency situation to then be followed by getting it back. Because we, just as I didn't envision in 78 some of the things that popped up, that might happen again. What you want is to get away from this idea that they can continue doing it.
Bobby Ray Inman served as head of the NSA in the late 1970s, shortly after the Church Committee, led by Senator Frank Church, conducted a major investigation into the country's intelligence agencies. The committee criticized the government for conducting widespread surveillance of citizens inside the country, and it led Congress to pass the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in order to establish some form of oversight over domestic surveillance programs. During its investigation, the Church Committee uncovered that several major corporations, including Western Union, ITT, and RCA Global, helped the NSA spy on Americans in a secretive program known as Project Shamrock. To talk about the Church Committee, we are joined right now by attorney Frederick Schwartz. He served as chief counsel to the Church Committee in the mid-70s. He's now senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law and co-author of the forthcoming book, Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Nice to see you.
It's good to have you with us. Tell us what happened then.
Well, it started in 1946 when all these major companies started turning over all their cables, every single cable that went out of the country, to the NSA. Initially, the government looked at those to see encrypted or coded messages coming from foreign embassies. But they began during the 60s and 70s to look at cables and other messages from people opposing the war in Vietnam and civil rights leaders. That was just one example of all the excessive surveillance and action that the government agencies were taking against people who were dissidents in the United States during the Cold War.
Explain Project Shamrock.
Well, Shamrock was the code name. They give all the things code names for the handing over of every single cable that left the country. For every day from 1946 until it was discovered in 1975 when it was stopped.
And What happened? How was it used? How did they actually do it then?
Well, I don't know the technology, but they would use electronic devices to check messages they wanted to look at. And it started, as I said, with a relatively benign purpose, one that most people would say is perfectly proper, looking at foreign embassies sending coded messages back to their home countries. But then it was shifted to looking at American anti-Vietnam war protesters and civil rights leaders to examine their communications. So it's an example of one of many of how when you've got a secret program and inadequate laws governing it, it's going to spread, and it's going to start perhaps in an appropriate way, and that it'll spread into something that's totally contrary to the First Amendment.
Could you talk about the cooperation of these companies in spying on Americans?
Well, they were asked to do it, and they did it.
Which ones?
It was the companies you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. ITT, RCA Global.
And the other one, whatever it was.
Western Union.
Western Union, yeah. And frankly, they then actually were less culpable than today. Then they simply were violating the privacy rights of their customers. But today, the FISA law, which was passed in 1978 as a consequence of the Church Committee's revelations, makes clear that the government is not meant to get messages from United States citizens without a warrant, except for a 3-day emergency period when they can proceed without a warrant, or when a war is declared, when they have a period of 15 days. But the law is very clear. Beyond that, it's criminal for the government to obtain messages without a warrant.
There was a fierce debate within the Church Committee about whether to name these companies that had cooperated with the government and spied on Americans. Talk about that debate.
Well, that's true. There was. I mean, everybody thought it was wrong. And the question was whether to name the companies. And ultimately, the Church Committee decided that it was the right thing to do, and I supported that view. It was the right thing to do because these companies knowingly had violated the rights of their customers.
The president weighed in through his attorney.
Yeah, the President Ford did, and they made a big fight about not disclosing those names, just as they'd made a big fight about not disclosing the fact the CIA had used the mafia to try and kill Fidel Castro. In both cases, the committee ultimately decided to release the information.
It wasn't common for the White House counsel to personally go to the committee, and
well,
he did
see,
on this issue.
The, it wasn't
said it
the
would
White
compromise
House.
National security.
Yeah, it wasn't the White House counsel. It was the Attorney General. But he was basically a good guy, Ed Levy, and he issued guidelines that began to curb the FBI. So he was on the side of reform, and in this case, he took a position that we disagreed with.
And said it would compromise national security.
Yeah, but of course that's silly. It doesn't compromise national security. I mean, most issues that really come to public attention, the government wants to conceal something because it's embarrassing, not because it compromises national security. Take torture today, you know, or sending people to be tortured in Egypt and Syria and so forth. That's not compromising national security to have it exposed. It's exposing wrongdoing that's embarrassing.
And, of course, for the companies, it's very embarrassing, and it could open them up to lawsuits.
Yeah, it didn't back then, and it has now. Who knows how those lawsuits are going to come out.
Well, I wanted to play for you a comment made last week by New York Times reporter James Risen. He, of course, broke the story about the NSA's domestic surveillance program and wrote the book State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. He spoke also at the forum on the NSA, sponsored by the New York Public Library and the Century Foundation.
I've never confirmed this, but I've heard that, you know, within the NSA, among the very few people who knew about this program, there was some concern, serious concern. Some people considered resigning. Some people refused to participate in the program. And what I heard was that the people who were the most concerned were the people who had lived through the whole Church Committee period. And that it was the young people who said, oh, yeah, let's do that, you know.
So it was the young people, he said, were the ones who said, let's go ahead and do that in the modern controversy, the older ones remembering church went a different route.
It's interesting. I think the church committee did teach lessons to people that if you shouldn't violate the law, you shouldn't use secrecy to cover up things merely because they're embarrassing. The another thing that I know he said at the at that conference was about General Hayden. I should say for a minute, the NSA is a very important agency for the United States. It has done and it does do very important things through their electronic intelligence work. But with respect to General Hayden, in the book, I've looked in the draft of the book, which is coming out next next winter, I've looked at General Hayden's comments, and I think when in his confirmation hearings, the Senate Intelligence Committee really needs to look very carefully at whether he was candid or honest in the comments he made after 9/11. You know, to make a fair judgment on that, you have to know not only what he said, but exactly what was being done when. But I think there's a credibility issue.
Candid about?
About whether the government, I think, see, the comments by both President Bush and General Hayden reassured the public that they were always getting warrants. But we now know they weren't. So there's a credibility issue there.
Going back to President Ford and the Church Committee, didn't Ford try to extend executive privilege to the private companies?
I don't know if they used that label. I don't think they did. They were really saying it's unfair to the private companies more than the use of the label executive privilege, which really wasn't being used back then, by the way, that label. Nixon began to use it, but it wasn't as common as it now is. We have a greater problem with secrecy today than we did back then.
In what way?
Because it's being used more often, I think, to try and cover up and keep secret things simply because they're embarrassing.
You think Congress needs to form a new church committee?
Well, whether Congress should do that or it should be done like the 9/11 commission was by private group, yes, I think it should be done. Congress now and the country now is much more partisan, much more divided than it was in 1975-76. And that makes a fair investigation much harder.
How concerned are you about what's happening today?
Well, you know, what I'm really concerned about is the theory that Dick Cheney first voiced many years ago, and he's continued to voice, and Bush's lawyers have voiced, which is that the theory that the president has the right to break the law. Now, and indeed that the Constitution gives the president the right to break the law. That's never been suggested before. It's being suggested now, and if it's not put down and defeated, we are in a slippery slope moving toward a much more totalitarian government that's like the monarchy, which we supposedly we tried to put behind us when we had the revolution 200 years ago.
Frederick Shores, I want to thank you very much for being with
us. Thank you.
Senior counsel, Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, served as the chief counsel to the Church Committee 30 years ago and is co-author of the forthcoming book, Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Thanks for joining us.
Okay,
this is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Army Surgeon General has issued an unusual warning about an upcoming film that airs this Sunday on HBO. In a memo to military personnel, Lieutenant General Kevin Kiley writes that watching the documentary could result in symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, such as flashbacks or nightmares. The film, Baghdad ER, chronicles life in the emergency room of the 86th Combat Support Hospital in Baghdad's Green Zone during a two-month period last year. It examines the daily lives of doctors, nurses, chaplains, and soldiers who work at one of the busiest hospitals in Iraq. Baghdad ER was screened Monday night at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C., and is scheduled to be shown at 22 military installations around the country. But it's already caused controversy because of its graphic footage of soldiers dead and dying. HBO screened the film in March for senior Army officials, including the Undersecretary of the Army, Pete Green. HBO's Executive Vice President, Richard Plepper, said the film received an enthusiastic response. But then last week, the Army suddenly seemed to withdraw support for the film. HBO's offer to co-sponsor a screening of the film this week at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where the 86th is based, was turned down by the Pentagon. And last week, the Army suddenly declined to attend Monday's screening. In addition, none of the highest-ranking officers or senior medical personnel attended the screening. After the screening, Sheila Nevins, president of HBO's documentary unit, told the Washington Post, quote, "Maybe people at the Pentagon feel the truth will discourage people from backing the war. The film certainly tells you what could happen in a war, but it's also about the heroism, courage, and dedication of our troops," she said. This is an excerpt of Baghdad ER.
"What all do we have to do to save his arm?
What are our options?
It doesn't look good.
He's just got a massive injury to his arm. He's going to lose it.
Hey, can you grab me an amputation set? Thanks,
Jeff. You're welcome.
All right, let's get this thing off.
This war and, and the number of lives it's affecting is just unbelievable. I have to think that the people in this country are in a better place for it, or will be in a better place for it. I have to believe that, because otherwise this is just sheer madness to me."
That was an excerpt of the film Baghdad ER, which will be shown on HBO this Sunday. We're joined now by the filmmakers who produced and directed the film, our colleagues John Alpert and Matt O'Neill, both award-winning filmmakers here at Downtown Community Television. Between them, they've won 14 national and local Emmy Awards. We're also joined from Alabama by Dr. James Hill, the flight surgeon in aviation medicine at Fort Rucker in Alabama. Dr. Hill spent a year as an emergency medical physician in the Combat Support Hospital in Baghdad. And on the phone with us is Paula Zwillinger. Her son, Marine Lance Corporal Robert Mininger, was killed in Iraq on June 6, 2005, 21 years old. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! We're going to begin with John Alpert. John, tell us about the mission you went on to Baghdad, you and Matt O'Neill.
We spent 2 months in the Combat Support Hospital in Baghdad. It's the main Army hospital, the most sophisticated facility that we have in Iraq. And when you're wounded and your life is on the line, that's where you're taken. And the Army gave us complete access. We were embedded. I was really quite surprised when we got there that the Army completely facilitated our access to the facility. They're extraordinarily proud of this facility. I've never seen doctors so dedicated. I've never seen miracles like this, and I've never seen horrors like this before.
Matt O'Neill, what most stands out for you as you were embedded in this unit in the emergency room?
For me, it's the relentless pace that the doctors are working under day after day. I mean, we spent 2 months there, and we came out exhausted and rattled by what we saw. And the doctors who were there, like Dr. Hill, were there for a year. And spending 12 months under those conditions, working the enormously hard shifts that they worked, is unbelievable.
Let's go to Dr. Hill in Alabama. Your response to this film, Baghdad ER, do you feel it captures what you went through, spending a year in the emergency medical unit, a combat support hospital in Baghdad?
Well, I don't think there's any film that can capture a whole year's worth of footage within an hour. But I definitely think that John Albert and Matt O'Neill hit a home run with this production. It was sensational. It gave me flashbacks. And I'm a person who was trained at one of the best trauma centers in the country down in Miami. And I thought I saw everything before I went to Baghdad. And within 6 hours, the facility showed me that I just saw the beginning, the tip of the iceberg. And after a year, I did feel like I was beat down. I mean, just run over.
What was hardest for you, Dr. Hill?
The hardest thing for me, and I believe it was for all the medical providers, was the difficulty in taking care of so many soldiers and at the same time having to take care of the Iraqi people that actually injured them. They'll be in one bed, the Iraqi person that shot four or five soldiers, and three of those soldiers may have died. And we still had to deal with our personal feelings and the medical ethics of taking care of that individual so they can stand trial. So we had a very big test of our morality of saving these people and that want to hurt us, that are definitely against us, and then also taking care of, you know, our American heroes.
I want to go to another clip of the HBO documentary that's going to air Sunday called Baghdad ER.
So this guy's obviously been shot in several places. He's got some fractures, and we're just looking at his films here. He's got a lot of shrapnel in his legs and stuff.
Man, it's a rubber knee.
You should feel it.
Very unstable fracture. Probably end up losing that limb.
These guys have injuries all over the place, and so you have to prioritize which injuries take precedence, life over limb.
I'm just a good West Texas boy, and back in West Texas, we thought we were seeing some stuff. But out here, it's all a whole nother ballgame.
Another excerpt of Baghdad ER. So, John Alpert, what happened? You were embedded. You had the full support of the unit and the Army. They knew you were there, obviously. I mean, the images of just the two of you with your cameras right in there on the in the surgeries. What happened?
What happened in terms of the latest reaction to this?
And then now, as this film is coming out, the Army pulling back.
The support from the people who were there on the ground, the people in the hospital, the people who every single day are there saving American lives, has not wavered at all. Everybody that we've spoken to feels honored by this film, is proud that they're part of it, and they want everybody in the United States to see it. It's been universal. There are people in some offices in the Pentagon that have had objections to this, but it's certainly not anybody who is in Iraq helping to keep Americans alive.
Well, what about the top brass? What happened? They originally did support what you're doing, and then at the Washington here screening where many of them were going to be, can you talk about the memos? Can you talk about what has turned around?
There certainly was an attempt at one point from the Secretary of the Army to see if HBO would change this film or alter it, and a phone call was made. And this is very sensitive. All these large media organizations are affected by congressional legislation. There's a bill going through Congress that you've been talking about on your show that if certain language is in, it's billions of dollars for Time Warner one way and billions the other way if the language is changed. And when somebody makes a phone call, it's intimidating. And to HBO's credit, you know, I've been in this situation before in the first Gulf War. Our reports came back and the news organizations wouldn't play it. And HBO basically looked back and said, you know, this is the truth, and it's going on the air. And I'm really proud to be associated with HBO on this because they didn't buckle.
The call that was made, Secretary of the Army called the president of HBO?
Not president. He called a vice president of HBO.
Who is that?
I don't know. I'm not privy to the conversation, but I do know that he wondered whether certain things in the program could be changed, and HBO said Hell no.
I think it's important to understand that every person that wears a uniform that's spoken to us, including the top people in the Army, the chief of staff of the Army, has said have nothing but respect for this film. And they've told us directly that they think that it accurately captures the truth of what's happening over there and the heroic efforts that the soldiers, the doctor soldiers, are making every day in Iraq.
Dr. Hill, why do you think this film has become so controversial, if it simply captures what you did on a daily basis in the Baghdad ER?
That's a really difficult question to answer. I'm more of a medical professional, emergency medicine physician, if you would. What we did there was just to save as many people as we possibly could. Our commander took care of the logistics. I took care of the medical expertise, as well as Dr. Pembre, who you'll see in the movie, and as well as many other doctors that were there every single day, just getting bloody and doing what we do.
I want to turn now to another clip from Baghdad ER that Major Hill is in as well.
Lord, you brought him to us. We tried everything we could to save his life. But it was not up to us. But Lord, we pray that his life and even his death might be used to hasten peace and end this terrible war.
Another crummy day in Baghdad.
Yes. Yeah.
Very young. Very young. PFC hasn't been in very long, and specialist could have been in a few years, but could have come in as a specialist. But
a lot of young kids over here getting hurt.
Major Hill, you're there as the person is dying, saying another crummy day in Baghdad. Your feelings when someone dies?
I feel a personal loss because it's my patient. I take responsibility for each one of my patients, whether they end up in the morgue or they end up in the OR and make it back to their families. It feels like a triumph when we get them back to their families and they give us a call and say, thanks a lot. I really appreciate everything you did for me. And tell you the truth, I didn't do anything that I don't normally do. This is what I was trained to do. This is what I love to do. And I just love to see our American guys getting back to their families.
We're also joined on the phone by Paula Zwillinger. Her son, U.S. Marine Lance Corporal Robert Mininger, was killed in Iraq June 6, 2005. He was 21 years old. This film has to bring back memories for you. First of all, condolences on the loss of your son, Paula.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
How important do you think it is for people to see these images?
I think it's very important. It brings the reality of the war into the home. Right now, as we've talked about previously, what is the public really seeing nowadays? They're seeing a paragraph on the second page of a newspaper saying that, you know, we lost X number of lives today, whether it be an IED, whether a tank rolled over. And it's just a little paragraph, and you don't really get the visual image of really what war is about until you see the movie. It's very easy to read it in the paper. There's no getting around it. It's a little cold. It's not detailed. You know, you never get details in the newspaper. But when you see the documentary, it really hits home because it's reality. You know, what you're going to see is war, and it's the outcome of war, whether it be positive or negative.
And your feelings now about the Army seeming to pull back, withdraw support from showing this film, saying it's going to cause post-traumatic stress, and even putting pressure on HBO to change this film, to delete scenes?
Well, you know, I have an opinion, and, you know, the more I think about it, as John mentioned, that, you know, it does have political ties to it. But, you know, everybody has to take from this documentary their own feelings. And right now, with the everybody has an opinion about the war. Of course, with the polls and everything showing, you know, where the American public really decides as to our opinion as to whether we should be there or not and how things have changed. I mean, that's an ever ongoing situation, but it definitely has a strong image of what war is about.
Paula, Matt and John brought you to New York because they had filmed the death of your son in the Baghdad ER.
Correct.
You alone watched this with your husband. What were your feelings?
Well, you have to understand that I initially had 17 hours where I knew nothing. It was, in essence, a black hole. I had many questions that I thought I would never get the answers to. And 5 months later, after, you know, losing Bob, Matt called me and told me about the documentary that they were working on. And for me to see this footage again of my son literally puts me at his bedside. And I think that is a precious gift that any parent would take, that to literally be there at your son's bedside. You know, it's, you have to wonder timing of it and everything as to why they were there when Bob came through the door, you know, all those little coincidences and things of that nature. But in reality, it has given me peace. It has given me closure. It has answered some of my questions that I've had. It has given me the opportunity to talk with the doctors and the nurses who took care of him. Not every parent gets those answers in a time of war when their child is, you know, injured or killed overseas. And again, you know, I'm very fortunate that I have that now. So I look at it as a gift.
John Alpert.
And on our part, it was an honor to meet Paula. It was an honor to meet the doctors who tried to save her son's life, and people like Dr. Hill, who every single day were working in ways that just made me so proud to be with them. And I'm actually appreciative to the Army, because the Army did everything they could to help us capture this. It's my firm belief that the soldiers in uniform want every American to see this film, and they're proud of it, and I'm proud to have been part of it, and I want to thank all the military people that helped us.
Do you think it will be shown on Fort Campbell?
It was shown in Fort Campbell last night to a very enthusiastic response. We've talked to the soldiers, right? You talked to
some of them. I talked to some of the soldiers who saw the film yesterday in Fort Campbell in a closed screening just for people in the cache who were involved with the film. And one major called me up and she said, I don't understand what the warnings are about. You guys only showed the tip of the iceberg. They were saying this was gruesome, and you showed nothing.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The film will air on Sunday night on HBO Baghdad ER. Matt O'Neill, John Alpert, the filmmakers, Paula Zwillinger, thank you for being with us. And Dr. Hill in Alabama, thank you so much. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.